Hello and welcome to another episode of Truth News Radio Australia. It's the 22nd of June 2008 and I'm Herewood Fenton, and tonight we're going to be talking about a variety of international and local news, starting with the impeachment of George Bush, led by Congressman Denis Kucinich, draconian measures to be passed through the London Parliament under the auspices of Gordon Brown, radical changes to Canada's intellectual property laws, which may have effect to many of us around the world, implications of an Israeli military exercise possibly being a precursor to a full-scale military attack against Iran, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the Israeli situation in Gaza and the West Bank and its implications for world peace. Now, to cover the international news in detail, I'll hand you over to Josh Jackson.
Belfast Telegraph. Tuesday, the 10th of June. US congressman moves to impeach Bush. Former Democratic presidential contender Denis Kucinich has called for the impeachment of George W. Bush, claiming that the president set out to deceive the nation and to violate his oath of office with the Iraq War. The Ohio representative yesterday introduced 35 articles of impeachment against Bush on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives.
This was actually introduced around about the 10th of June, I think, possibly.
That's right. So saying yesterday, it would have been the 9th of June. The article goes on to say, Kucinich unveiled a list of alleged illegal and improper acts by Bush, including war crimes. He accused Bush of executing a calculated and wide-ranging strategy to deceive the citizens of the Congress into believing that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the United States. Now, he introduced 35 articles of impeachment. Now, what that means is 35 different points. So Article 1, for instance, is creating a secret propaganda campaign to manufacture a false case for war against Iraq. Now, that's so widely known.
I think it's excellent that he's led with the most strongest and most shocking of the potential, I guess, crimes. Because really, he's phrased it in a very stark way, which I approve of.
Absolutely, yeah. It goes on and on. I mean, look, Article 6. Invading Iraq in violation of requirements of the HJ Resolution 114. So it goes really into deep international law. But then also Article 5 is illegally misspending funds to secretly begin a war of aggression, to more of an article of...
Well, it's basically leading into a variety of things that could be leveled against him that probably need to be fully fleshed out in an investigation and a judicial inquiry where they would have subpoena powers.
Absolutely, and saying that Article 5 is more of a moral issue, whereas Article 6 is more of a law issue. Which I mean, they all turn into law
Indeed. Eventually.
I mean, wars of aggression are illegal.
Indeed, and I think the real significance of this impeachment, if it ever gets up, will be that it does take away some of the protection that the president and the vice president have had, where they basically have been able to just avoid answering questions. Once it goes to impeachment hearings, they won't be able to have those protections. Of course, we don't have a lot of confidence that this will ever get up, but it's extremely important.
How can the Americans feel that they've got two sides of a story when they overwhelmingly voted to have the Democrats in power because they will pull out of the war? That was the promise. And the Democrats have always stated flat out impeachment is off the table. How can impeachment ever be off the table? And I absolutely admire Kucinich for this push. I just think it's just wonderful. And
look, he's a man of great integrity. I've listened to him. I've watched quite a number of interviews with him, And I've come to have great respect for the man. And I've got more hopes for him than I do for Ron Paul at present. He has a certain presence about him, and he has a certain consistency, and he's actually more of the liberal left-wing variety than Ron Paul, who really represents more of the paleo-conservative. And I think it's really important to not have this movement dominated by one or the other side of politics in terms of its sort of basic constituency. So it's really important to have someone from the traditional left.
Absolutely. And Kucinich, I mean, look at Article 34, the second to last article, is obstruction of the investigation into the attacks of September 11th.
Indeed, indeed.
So, you know, there is so many articles being pushed on here, and it's fantastic that he is coming from the Democratic side.
Well, look, we know from certain things that Kucinich has said, which he hasn't, he's been reluctant to make any strong statements about September 11th, but from what he has said on interviews on the Alex Jones show and various other things that I've seen him say and write, that he is very much aware that there is a serious problem with the 9/11 official theory. Now, he has wisely refrained from making that the focus of his inquiry, but the fact that he's made it a part of the impeachment proceedings is extremely significant. I mean, here we have a man in Congress. This is far better than the situation with Cynthia McKinney, because Cynthia McKinney was,
Greens representative in America.
Well, she's now Greens, but she was a congresswoman in Parliament. Sorry, in the U.S. Congress, in the Democratic Party. She was thrown out. She was voted out of office. Now she is now representing the Greens, but for many years she was a congresswoman. When she started expressing and questioning September 11, she led a very vigorous questioning against Donald Rumsfeld in the House. She lost her seat very quickly. You know, as tremendous as that was that she did that, I think that Kucinich's way he's approaching this is spot on. I think that I've got great hopes for this man.
Well, the articles, you know, they cover everything from failure to plan for the predicted disaster of Hurricane Katrina and failure to respond to civil emergencies, to the September 11th attacks, to the war in Iraq, and to the war in Afghanistan. It just goes on and on.
You are listening to Truth News Radio Australia, a radio show exploring globalist tyranny, mass media deception, and the New World Order from an Australian perspective. Now broadcasting weekly on all frequencies and throughout the blogosphere. Find us at www.truthnews.com.au. Our next story for tonight. Recently, new laws have been passed through the UK Parliament which allow the government to detain terror suspects for 42 days. This is an increase from 28 days, which had been the previous limit. Now, this move, and I'll hand over to Josh here to discuss this in depth, but this move to me seems one of these most alarming and insidious erosions of civil liberties. And although it doesn't affect us directly in Australia, I'm sure that these things will inevitably sort of filter across to us. Well, what do you think about that, Josh?
It has always been the case that once England or America push the boundaries or initiate some sort of law, we indefinitely follow sometime in the future. We always follow. Now, I'm not sure about all of the ins and outs, because a lot of these papers are very, very, you know, hidden within deep legal language. But I agree, this is holding someone for 42 days on extremely broad terror laws.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Really.
That's right. And
I mean, we're talking about depriving someone of their liberty for 42 days. They may have done nothing wrong.
And if it's in America, you know, they hold people without
America, the situation
lawyer.
In America is in reality, far worse. However, the Constitution of America is stronger But the problem is, in America, they've found loopholes to get around the Constitution, and they are actually detaining people as what they call illegal combatants or foreign enemies. And they're actually taking them on ships. They've actually got them on ships, or they've got them in Guantanamo Bay. What they're doing in America is equally shocking and possibly worse. But what we need to be concerned about is that what the UK is doing is writing this into law. They're writing it into law in such a way that a measure which by any normal standards would be considered totalitarian and fascist is now being normalized in the public mind.
And if people think that, oh, that's good because the terrorists might get you, you have to actually look into the fact that governments time and time again are always totally infiltrated into a lot of these terror plans and plots. Even if you go back to the IRA, the second under Sinn Féin, was Secret Service of Britain. I mean, and this is all declassified now.
There are well-known connections between many government representatives and the Secret Services.
So we have these governments that are totally corrupt, have shadowy, strange sections of the government causing constant, you know, little terrorist attacks here and manipulating social structures there. And we're meant to trust them with holding anybody they want for now 42 days?
Well, basically the whole tone of what's happened, and the same thing has happened in Australia, is that the use of intelligence and security measures to basically turn back on the country, to turn back on the people, so that essentially the people are now potentially the enemy. Your own people have become potentially the enemy. And they're classified in various ways. Well, we say that they're Islamic extremists. We say that we basically try to dehumanize them by emphasizing things about them that we've come to collectively fear and loathe, such as suicide bombings. And we're going to be getting a little bit into the suicide bombing question later in the show. But I think that the shocking thing here is the way in which we are being conditioned to accept that the government can declare that its own people an enemy.
That's right. And if you look at how the BBC is covering this, if you just Google the headline, which is Brown Wins Crunch Vote on 42 days. You look at how the BBC are covering this, and you know, 36 Labour MPs voted against the government. So they narrowly got this law through.
It was vigorously opposed.
That's right. But then look at this BBC. If you go down, the link says full list of rebels.
Yes, they had to call them rebels.
They had to call them rebels.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people that are opposed to draconian laws against the civil liberties of the citizens are called rebels.
At least one MP, I think, resigned over it, and I think he was a Conservative MP. And that's a man with some standards and some integrity.
Fantastic.
I mean,
it's sad because people with that integrity then leaving, you know, getting pushed out, bullied out.
Unfortunately, but when you see a politician willing to resign over a matter of conscience, see, those are the people we really need. But I think that being aligned with the current system, being aligned with the current power structure, would only ever be a sellout. And I think some of them realize that, and they get out when they can. Okay, we're just going to play a clip now of the Shadow Home Secretary David Davis giving his opinion on these developments.
Yes, I'm joined by the Shadow Home Secretary, who obviously made the argument today. The government won the vote, as we know, very narrowly on the main vote by 9. Now, David Davis, there are 9 DUP MPs. The government had the majority of 9. The DUP backed the government. You must be pretty disappointed with the Democratic Unionists this evening.
It's not just the DUP. There have been a whole series of shenanigans going on with a whole series of Labour backbenchers who we know don't believe in the principle of this bill. So I'm afraid we won the argument, but the government bought the vote today.
Now, I'll just pause it there because I think that phrase that was just used...
Bought the vote.
I mean, that really... that says something to me, doesn't it? I mean, does it say something to you?
Oh, absolutely. And a whole series of shenanigans.
Shenanigans bought the vote.
let's keep playing.
I mean, yeah. Okay.
Let's see
what
else he has to say.
We'll just keep it going.
Because, yeah, he's quite interesting.
Sure.
Say, Bot Devoe, do you have any evidence for that?
Well, you go around and ask them yourselves. Get the DUP to explain why they made their decision. Get all those other Labour members of Parliament why they made a decision when they said, in principle, they did not support this legislation. This legislation now has no parliamentary authority.
Clearly.
Look, I'm just going to pause it there again because I really think that we need to let this sink in and, yeah. and not let it sort of
wash over.
Yeah, not let it be washed over us and then we somehow normalize it. What was just stated there was very, very disquieting. But basically he's saying it has no in principle support and yet it went through.
Well, it just shows that there is some manipulation of parliamentarians to pass certain laws for someone or some organisation or group that wants that agenda.
Someone or something.
Something. Some sort of consciousness or... Because holding somebody for 42 days is without any evidence, without anything, is so scary.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they could literally come in here, knock the house down, knock the door down, grab us, and just throw us in prison, and then interrogate us up to the edge of death because they've
Well, we have rolling provisions here. Our provisions are a little different. We have a 7-day system here where they can hold you for 7 days, and they can go back and get another 7 days, and another 7 days, and another 7 days. Although, I think in the end, it's probably worse than the UK system because I'm not sure if there's any limit to the renewal. Although that's something
well,
I probably have to
that,
investigate.
Not only that, a day is constituted by 24 hours. And the fact of the matter is, it's been stated that people, the days are counted by in the amount of times you are interrogated and talked to.
So there's legal loopholes that are being exploited here.
That's right. If they're only talking to you for 3 hours that day, that only counts for 3 hours. So you've got to make up 24 of those to constitute 1 day.
Well, look, it just shows, and it just goes to show that the system that we're living under is not fair. It's not free, and folks, we've got to look at it.
Get angry.
Hello, you're listening to Truth News Radio. It's the 22nd of June, 2008. I'm Herewood Fenton, and I'm here with Josh Jackson. And we are talking about world events that are of extreme importance. Now, everything we talk of is of extreme importance, but this next topic is quite a shocker, and it's kind of snuck up on me, and only by studying it in depth have I begun to realize its true significance. Title of the story, as published in the Sydney Morning Herald, is Digital Copyright, It's All Wrong. A draft treaty proposes draconian measures to protect copyright. Now, the nitty-gritty of this whole story is complex. There's a lot of bureaucratic red tape, and it involves international trade agreements, the G8 summit, and things that are hard for many people to grasp. But when you get right down to the nub of it, it involves invasions of your privacy, which are quite shocking. I'll hand over to Josh for a more detailed discussion.
Well, look, this article in the Sydney Morning Herald was written by Graham Phillipson, who I absolutely congratulate because it's a great article. And I get everyone to Google it, Digital Copyright, It's All Wrong, and post it on their blogs and talk about it because it truly is full on. And we're going to come back next week and talk with our expert on digital copyright, Max, next week. But for now, I'll just read you a part of this article. The forces of reaction are fighting back, as they often do. They are carrying out their planning in secret in the knowledge that if more people knew of their activities, they would not be allowed to get away with it. The US has circulated a draft discussion paper on a possible anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the ACTA, for the next G8 meeting in Tokyo in July. The full text of the document has been published on WikiLeaks, and that you can find that at wikileaks.org. The ACTA draft is a scary document, the article continues. If a treaty based on its provisions were adopted, it would enable any border guard in any treaty country to check any electronic device for any content that they suspect infringes copyright laws. They need no proof, only suspicion.
This is quite exceptional in its depth, well, they breadth, don't, and scope.
What's suspicion? You know, oh, you have a mobile phone that could have MP3. I'm suspicious that could have an MP3 on it. Grab it, delete everything on it.
Now, we should emphasize that this is a trade agreement. Okay, so what this means is this precedes the application of law, but this requires any country which signs up to the trade agreement to place the law into effect. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, absolutely. It is in the constitution of the trade agreement, the free trade agreements that would be in play with all the whole G8 countries, and not only that, within the European unions, the Asian unions, the American unions, which will be put into place very soon. The article continues. They will be able to seize any device, laptop, iPod, DVD recorder, mobile phone, etc., and confiscate it or destroy anything on it, merely on suspicion. On the spot, no lawyers, no rights of appeal, no nothing. And you've got to understand, Harrowood,
it's incredible.
This isn't, folks, this isn't there to protect any copyright issues or anything like that. This is purely, I mean, imagine in the future when these laws are in place and the government doesn't like a certain blogger or journalist that's writing a piece about something. They'll say, look, grab that guy's laptop when he goes through the airport and just destroy it. No rights of appeal, no lawyer, no nothing. Just, well, we're suspicious that you might have an MP3 on there.
Well, the really scary part of this, Josh, is that we don't even know how it might be applied. But we know that within a construct where invasions of privacy are now being advocated as necessary for anti-terrorism measures, that this could easily be rolled in to basically allow people to be detained and searched and have their belongings and their equipment kind of scanned, which it exceeds anything that's currently possible, and possibly that they will combine the anti-terror aspects with the copyright infringement.
I can pretty
aspects.
Much guarantee that that's going to happen. You know, if you just look at the news and where it's all heading, if you just project the line, that's absolutely where it's heading.
Now, I'd just like to point out that, for the average person here, for the average, your co-workers, if you were to mention this, many of them will just raise their eyebrows and shrug. And they'll say,
they can't do, they can never get away with that.
And a lot of people just say, big deal, you know, that in reality, they won't do it. Or people will shrug their shoulders and basically looking at something which is on the face of it, quite shocking, quite alarming and insidious, but they'll let it pass.
And what is actually happening here is building the infrastructure. And that's the important thing, folks. It's not these little laws and saying that they'll never get away with it. Now, the article goes on. The draft contains other draconian measures. It proposes a governing body for copyright protection that would operate outside organizations such as the World Trade Organization and the UN. So in short, it proposes a global police force answerable to no one with intrusive powers that vastly exceed those currently available to adherents of the concept of intellectual property. The proposed treaty is being sponsored, and this is where it all sort of bubbles up to the surface, by a small group of US Congress members, all of whom WikiLeaks says have received significant contributions from major record companies and film studios. As they say, follow the money.
Look, this is an assault on human rights. This is a globalist-inspired assault on human rights. And also, Josh, these trade agreements have been seen in the past to be precursors to the development of what goes by a better name, global government. Because They require all participating countries to enforce the same laws. And once you can do that from above, you essentially have global governance, even if you don't have global government.
And folks, you've got to understand, this is a fantastic piece of educational material, because people see free trade agreements as these great things. People see unions like the European Union or the Rudd's proposed Asian Union as an okay thing, as, oh, that doesn't matter. But look at it already. Here we are saying that they want a police force that's outside of any jurisdiction to be able to confiscate any electrical device that you might have purely on suspicion.
Well, that raises interesting questions. I don't know whether they actually would contemplate having their own kind of special force. It almost sounds like it. There'd be a roaming squad of enforcers that could turn up at airports. And I mean, would they wear a uniform? Would they? I mean, how would they identify themselves? And what sovereignty would they be adherent to?
Well, it reminds me of that great quote of Mussolini's.
Well, indeed, corporatism is the perfect merger of big business with government. Basically, corporations and government working together to achieve the same ends.
Which is the perfect fascism.
This is what Mussolini apparently said in one of his speeches, and it's an oft-quoted quote. And believe me, when governments and corporations work together to achieve their ends, it's not good, folks. It's not about making you a happy camper. It's quite the reverse. It's about totalitarianism. It's about total control. It's about domination. And in the end, it becomes genocide in every case.
Well, there's a great documentary called The Corporation. And within that documentary, it goes on about psychologically analyzing a corporation as a human being.
Yeah, I highly, highly regard it.
And in that, they say, look, if you took the corporation, because as by law, a corporation, LTD, is seen as a human being, as an entity. Now, if it was broken down psychologically, it would be categorized as a psychopath, because it has one goal, and that goal is profits for shareholders, and it disregards every other thing, human rights, everything. So
it's a trick, in a way. It's a trick that was invented to allow groups of wealthy men to gather together to apply pressure to government outside of what was actually allowable at the time. So the corporation was a form of basically group pressure applied, so that whereas a group of people would normally be considered a group of individuals working separately, a corporation is considered as a single entity.
And if now you marry a psychopath with government, it's all over, folks. So now, copyright, it really isn't about copyright. This is a step for global police and policing outside jurisdictions that have any sort of feedback or ways of legislating against or suing. You basically have no say. So these people are nameless and shameless.
It's another step in the slow erosion of freedoms, which we've seen, and we'll be keeping our eye on it, and we'll be discussing it again next week
with Max.
With Max. Okay, moving on with our next segment for the international section of the show. This is a big one, and it's one that is going to affect all of us, and this is the continuous, ominous, and imminent threat of an attack against Iran. Many of us have possibly become slightly jaded about the endless propaganda and the endless talk of this, and finding it never occurs, finding it's talked about and then forgotten about and then comes back again in the media. I don't think this is something that we can just treat as merely news entertainment. This is a continuous and very, very disturbing pattern of threatening another sovereign nation. And one thing in particular that I want to emphasize is that the means to do so has been proven now, with military exercises being conducted by Israel within the last 2 weeks, which have involved 99 aircraft, a massive exercise by any standards. And the Israeli government has not been very forthcoming on it. They've basically said, well, we often do exercises to prove various things. But sources within the US administration in published mainstream articles have said that this was most likely a preparation, a drill for an attack against Iran.
The thing is, a constant threat by the news medias and it, not only the news medias, because they get their press releases from defense organizations and defense secretaries. A constant threat of a country is a form of violence. Could you imagine constantly being told that your country is going to get invaded by the most powerful nation in the world? That F-16s are doing routine practice runs about to get ready for the bombing of your country if your president doesn't do a certain thing here and there.
Now, there's another point I'd like to make, that when these threats were being made most vocally, which was about 2 weeks ago, and I've got an article here which was published by the BBC. Now, this is from around about the first week of June. There was talk within the Israeli Knesset, and I'll just give you a quote here from Ehud Olmert. "The international community has a duty and a responsibility to clarify to Iran through drastic measures that the repercussions of their continued pursuit of nuclear weapons will be devastating." Now, the title of this story, which was published, as I say, on the round about the first week of June, "Analysis: Growing Talk of Iran Attack." The BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, looks at increasing speculation that Iran may come under attack because of its nuclear program. Now, folks, the day after that story went live, the price of oil jumped by about $10 a barrel, immediately on the heels of this story. Now, I and many and others have commented on the fact that that was not a coincidence. This threat and the price of oil going up were directly connected. Now, during that same week, which was not reported at the time, the Israelis conducted this massive military exercise. Okay, that's now only being reported now. I'll just give you a breakdown of the military exercise. More than 100 Israeli F-16 and F-15 fighters participated in the maneuvers, which were carried out over the eastern Mediterranean and over Greece during the first week of June, American officials said. The exercise included Israeli helicopters that could be used to rescue downed pilots. The helicopters and refueling tankers flew more than 900 miles, which is about the same distance between Israel and Iran's uranium enrichment plant at Natanz, American officials said.
See, US officials say things like, well, they live in a tough neighborhood. You know, they need to conduct large-scale exercises. But at the end of the day, these are all more threats. And when you get constant threatening, well, threats are a form of violence, and I keep saying that, but it's a very important thing to say, because by violently threatening someone, it's a form of terrorizing them.
Well, look, we've had a statement from the leader of Israel threatening devastating consequences to Iran. We have American officials leaking that this military maneuver probably has something to do with Iran. And, I mean, we have evidence that this event actually occurred. So I don't think we need much more. I mean, you know, the only further evidence you're going to get is when they actually do it. And then it'll be one of those CNN, you know, extravaganzas where everyone sits glued to their television for 2 weeks while they watch the fireworks of another attack on another country. And it will happen that suddenly. And you see, some people think that they now need some sort of false flag event to make this happen. Wrong. They don't need anything to make this happen. They've already got their so-called justification. And this is the Israeli claims and, you know, U.S. claims that the Iranians are developing a nuclear program. I think that the belief that some sort of terrorist event is needed as a trigger is wrong. I think this attack could go ahead based on some discovery that they will mention afterwards. Oh yes, we found out that they definitely had it. We thought they did, and we found out they did, so we just had to do it.
If the world doesn't understand that the whole reason we went into Iraq was based on the same lie that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq has the ability to create weapons of mass destruction, they could launch within minutes. If the Western world doesn't wake up to this, we're going to see the deaths of more children, of more innocent civilians, and the large-scale profits of the industrial military complexes again and again and again. It is so transparent, folks, that this is all to do with the American dollar and Iran threatening to trade oil and flood the world with cheap oil, trading it in euros. The leader of Iran recently got up to the OPEC summit and put the proposal forward that they should all be trading in euros because the failing American dollar is driving the oil price up. If this happens, America's economy would collapse overnight, folks. If the Middle East stopped trading oil and stopped buying American debt, the American dollar would collapse and we would see a world recession because the American dollar is the reserve currency of the world. We're not running on gold and silver anymore. We have got vast amount of infrastructure all based on debt, which the Middle East is buying, has been forced to buy. The only people in the 1960s who refused to sign the pact that they will trade in American dollars and buy American debt for their oil is Iraq, Afghanistan and Iran.
And we can certainly provide references for that.
Absolutely.
This information can be found by Googling it. There's research on this, and we need to really make it clear that this is not mere speculation. This is well-established fact.
So you've got to really look behind what is going on in the Middle East. It's a restructuring of the oil because America can't, you know, there is vast reservoirs of oil around the world that they could spring up and it would.
Oh yeah, I mean we need to address the popular misconception that the world is running out of oil, because this is widely believed, it's widely held, and it is according to what I know, and like it is hard to sum it up in a short segment like what we've got now.
Well, it's a massive fiscal policy with a lot of ins and outs of trade agreements and
but you've got to read between the news as well, and you've got to be aware when certain things do leak out. For instance, about a month ago, a report came out showing that Iraq has three times as much oil as what they previously thought. Now, Iraq was already the second biggest oil reserve in the world. If it has three times what they previously thought, that means probably Iraq in itself has enough oil to fuel the world for 100 years. I mean, the amount we're talking about here are absolutely vast. And they're continually discovering more and more. There are reserves all over the United States. There are reserves in Alaska. Venezuela has huge reserves. There is a vast amount of untapped oil. And analysts and people, geologists who've researched this can confirm that for you.
Exactly. And it's not about that. It is about the way the oil is traded. It is about the currency that it's traded in. It's about the debt that's traded for the oil to be to have the oil at a cheaper price. It's all about these things. And when America's economy is based on a war economy. They used to be a manufacturing economy, but that's all been taken over by China and other countries. And their economy is basically now a military economy. About 43% of it, is military, and they have to. And their economy is collapsing. So, if the Middle East started trading in euros, the American dollar would just collapse overnight. And B, they need another strike and they need to keep perpetual war.
I should also say that this is going to have a really, really adverse effect on Israel itself. If Israel is involved in this attack, if Israel conducts this attack, as is now being mooted, the effect on the Israeli people is going to be horrific. Mm. And I really do think that the population of Israel is terribly misled by their own government. If they believe that engaging in aggressive military action against a country that has not attacked them is actually going to make them safer, it is going to cause an epidemic of suicide attacks on Israel. It will cause the average Israeli to be 100 times worse off than what they are now. And this just leads me back again to the globalist tendency to manipulate citizens of countries into kind of empire agendas while making the citizens of those countries feel that they somehow have a stake in it, that it's somehow for them. It is not for them.
The poor Israeli people will suffer immensely if this happens. And the poor, the whole region, the poor citizens of that entire region will suffer so greatly, and it is so tragic that they believe that they're doing the right thing by it. I mean,
and who will suffer the most of all, I can tell you, is the population of Gaza and the West Bank. Now, this is a subject that I want to get into a little bit in this discussion, because these are the victims. These are the end victims of the chain of what actually occurs.
Oh, and the Israeli people are the victims as well.
I agree, but in this case, I think that there is a proportionality, and the proportionality of pain and suffering that is experienced on a daily basis by people in the Gaza and the West Bank is, and verifiably by statistics, about 8 to 10 times greater than what the Israelis experience. And I don't want to diminish for one second the psychological and, traumatic aspect of suicide bombings on the Israeli people.
But the only reason you have suicide bombings is when people are down in the worst ditch they could possibly think. People don't just suicide bomb themselves because they're living well and happy.
Well, I mean, that's an excellent point. And I recommend strongly to the audience to take a look at a couple of documentaries which were made in the last few years. They're not current. They were made in about 2003, 2004. It's virtually impossible for camera crews to get into Gaza now. So these two documentaries, which were made around about the same time, are the last kind of historical record we have of what is really going on there. And one of them is called Death in Gaza, and it was made by a British documentary maker. And the other one is called The Killing Zone, which was also made by a British documentary maker.
And you can see these on Google Video.
Yes, Google for them. Google for The Killing Zone and Google for Death in Gaza. And I actually looked at these films myself yesterday. And I mean, I already knew a fair bit about it. But when you actually see the human aspect of what goes on there, it's very different to thinking about it abstractly. And when you see children who live in a situation where their brothers and sisters are being killed in front of their eyes.
Oh, it's so sad.
Where you see a child sitting at a desk in a classroom get shot in the head by a stray Israeli bullet. Now, the interesting thing in that particular story is that the filmmaker went and asked the Israelis what happened. The Israelis said, oh, well, there were gunmen in the area. We were firing back a stray bullet. And the stray bullet just went right through the school building, into a classroom, through the head of an eight-year-old girl. And she died right in front of her classmates.
Oh.
Now, during the film, the filmmaker goes back to the classroom to discuss and talk about the event. And while they're talking, a huge explosion is heard as a shell lands somewhere near. Yeah. And the children are in a state of absolute shock, fear. They're shaking. It is a really shocking thing to watch. I mean, it will bring you to tears. Yeah. I mean, this is what you've got to understand. When these people are subjected to this kind of daily regime, the it's not just about one person being killed. It's about traumatizing an entire generation of children.
Yeah.
And those children, those little girls have brothers. And those little brothers, who might be 8 or 9 years old now, are already saying that they want to be martyrs. And what is actually created is a culture of death. Among the people who live in Gaza, the culture of death has become the dominant culture. So in other words, they value death more than they value life, because to die a martyr means that you have done something positive.
Yeah.
And they
the hope that one day your country will be liberated and free of these crimes. Yeah.
They don't even allow their sisters to cry at these funerals. Crying is forbidden, because crying is weakness, and also crying implies that death is something wrong. This is why they become suicide bombers.
So
you've got to
sick,
understand
it.
Because they've lived surrounded by death. They've had dead bodies around them for so much of their lives, that death is actually a positive thing. They've created this alternative reality. And they will happily become suicide bombers. There is no way to stop it now. You've got a whole generation of them.
See, but this is
ready
what the
to throw themselves
the military
in front of bullets,
complex
blow
love.
Themselves up.
They love this perpetual feeling that death is this great thing, that people then go off and, you know, people fighting with sticks and stones against extreme armaments start to build a culture that death is a great thing.
Now, we're just going to play you a song written in honor of an American activist who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer. And the song is The Lonesome Death of Rachel Corrie. The song actually adapted from a song by Bob Dylan. I'll hand it over to Billy Bragg.
An Israeli bulldozer killed poor Rachel Corrie as she stood in its path in the township of Rafa. She lost her young life in an act of compassion, trying to protect the poor people of Gaza, whose homes are destroyed by tank shells and bulldozers, and whose plight is exploited by suicide bombers who kill in the name of the people of Gaza. But Rachel Corrie believed in non-violent resistance, put herself in harm's way as a shield of the people, and paid with her life in a manner most brutal. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize our fears, take the rag away from your face, 'cause now ain't the time for your tears. Rachel Corrie had 23 years. She was born in the town of Olympia, Washington, a skinny, messy, list-making chain smoker who volunteered to protect the Palestinian people who had become non-persons in the eyes of the media, so that people were suffering and no one was seeing or hearing or talking or caring or acting. And the horrible math of the awful equation that brought Rachel Corrie into this confrontation? Is that the spilled blood of a single American is worth more than the blood of 100 Palestinians? But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize our fears, take the rag away from your face, 'cause now ain't the time for your tears. The artistic director of a New York theater cancelled a play based on Rachel's writings, but she wasn't a bomber or a killer or a fighter, but one who acted in the spirit of the Freedom Riders. Is there no place for such a voice in America that doesn't conform to the Fox News agenda, who believes in non-violence instead of brute force, who is willing to confront the might of an army whose passionate beliefs were matched by her bravery? And the question she asked rings out round the world: if America is truly the beacon of freedom, then how can it stand by while they bring down the curtain and turn Rachel Corrie into a non-person? Oh, but you who philosophize disgrace, criticize all fears, bury the rag deep in your face, 'cause now is the time for your tears.
Thanks, Billy Bragg, for that amazing song.
Wow, yeah. Oh, that was amazing. What an amazing song, yeah.
The song, there's actually a little story behind, well, my discovery of that song, because I've got an interest in Bob Dylan, and I was learning a song called "The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll," which is the song that this is based on, and it was actually on Dylan's third album, and it's one of Dylan's great songs, and the ability to translate it into a more current theme, I think, is really, really excellent, because we need culture and art to reflect the important issues of our time.
Especially amazing people that stand up to, you know, military conflicts by way of nonviolent resistance. I mean, that is just so admirable.
Yeah.
It's so amazing that having a mere song written about it is never enough, but so strong.
I should point out that the demolitions of Palestinian homes in Gaza is another aspect of the terrorizing of the population
by bulldozers, yeah, and tank shells,
which you've really got to look at some of these films to get the full impact of it. I mean, these are not just your average bulldozers you'll see on a construction site. These are militarized vehicles. These are like giant tanks that also have a bulldozer thing in front of them, right? They are military vehicles which have been specially commissioned by American construction companies for the Israeli government to do this appalling.
Yeah, you saw the same tanks during the what are those, the people in America who shacked up in
Waco?
Waco, yeah. You saw the same tanks going in there with these bulldozer endings on them and just pushing through. Yeah.
That was a while ago, yeah. But I think that the current generation of militarized equipment that the Israelis use is quite unique in its. I mean, these things I've seen them, you know, and they move at an incredible speed. They're not slow like your average bulldozer. They can go at like, I mean, looks, you can see them racing along at what looks like 60 or 80 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
They can demolish a house in seconds, and quite often the people inside the house only get a few seconds warning. I mean this is just one step away from mass murder. So, but it's not called murder because they do give the people that brief few seconds to get away. But I mean, imagine you're sitting in your home. I mean, I'm sitting in my home right now. My whole life is around me. All my books, my things, everything, my computers. Now, imagine a giant bulldozer came and just demolished my entire home on the pretext of making the country safer against terrorism. Now, if that were done to me, I would probably be turned into a terrorist overnight. I would be transformed from being what I am, which is a peaceable human being. If my entire world was destroyed,
well,
if all my property
go?
Was destroyed, I would think, well, why don't I become a terrorist? Because there's really nothing else to do. I mean, I'm being terrorized. I'm being hunted down like an animal. My entire world has been destroyed. I might as well be a terrorist. And this is exactly what is happening. And it's very hard for me to understand the logic behind the Israelis saying that they're doing this to make Israel safer. I cannot understand.
There is no logic. The logic is based around perpetual war so that armaments keep on getting sold, so that there is a constant feeling of fear and anxiety. You know, and then you get the Americans saying that Israel is in a bad neighborhood.
Yeah, well, it's a neighborhood that's been ruined. we can certainly say that. I mean, look, there's always been problems. There's always been conflict. But look, these things occur, and the history of the Middle East is not, you know,
full of peace, and
it's certainly not. But what we've seen in the history of the last 100 years has been empire building, colonial empire building from the British through to the Americans, continually manufacturing war and terribly affecting the people there. And what we saw in the post-Second World War period was the ethnic cleansing of Palestine by the Zionist movement, who were protected and funded from Europe, from America, from the UK.
And I find it extraordinary that the Iranian Prime Minister gets misquoted to saying that he wants Israel wiped off and pushed into the ocean.
Indeed.
And that's like a misquote, totally sound bit saying
the
that...
The correct quote was, I believe, that Iran should be effaced from the... Sorry, Israel should be effaced from the page of time.
And I think he was talking about the government of Israel and not the people.
Well, I saw an interesting interview with Ahmadinejad on this topic, which was also, you can Google for it. I think it was conducted by NBC in the last couple of years. And they specifically asked Ahmadinejad again about his position on this. And it was a very revealing interview, I can tell you, because Ahmadinejad said that they have misrepresented what he is saying. And he brought it back again to the Palestinians. They were particularly talking about references that Ahmadinejad had made about the Holocaust not being real and about his position towards Israel as a state. Now, in regards to the Holocaust, he merely pointed out that the Palestinians didn't do anything to the Jewish people. The Palestinians were not involved in killing 6 million Jews.
Yeah.
Why are they being punished? Because
right.
they had nothing to do with it.
That's right.
And the second point he makes about Israel is that the state of Israel, as it's currently formed, is not equitable from the point of view of what we call democracy. It's not equitable. I mean, it's a state that's based on racial lines. It has a basic racial premise. Now, this is not, I mean, we've learned that that was wrong. I mean, we knew it was wrong in South Africa. We knew it was wrong in the American South in the early 1960s. Why is it not wrong in Israel? Again, I don't understand why something that we've been grown up and taught that is wrong in most of the world, for some reason in Israel, to have a state based on racial lines that give preferences and rights of Jewish people against non-Jewish people is somehow okay.
And you know, the poor Israeli people who are living with constant fear of getting suicide bombed.
Well, I think they're being misled. I think they're deeply misled, just as we are misled, just as people in America are misled and in the UK. And
yeah,
many
but you can't
countries.
Say it doesn't happen. I mean, it happens. People just blow themselves up at a cafe or at a bus stop and have lost, you know, kids and children. In fact, you know, it does happen quite often. But it happens because the perpetual constant fearing and killing of young children, of you know, in these documentaries you'll see soldiers popping random people in the head from great heights, snipers just killing someone.
This is commonplace in Gaza, or at least it was until a few years ago. I'm not sure what the current situation is now, but it was commonplace for bullets to come whizzing down certain streets in Gaza. And in the documentary I saw, the documentary maker was running and hiding, right, because she was under threat. But the people there are so used to it that they don't even react, because they've learned to just accept it as a risk of walking around. The odd bullet whizzes by. Yeah, and you know, your chance of getting hit is small. But statistically, and we'll get to the statistics in a minute, because I actually really want to bring this up, statistically, it's not looking too good. It's not looking too good for a Palestinian in Gaza. And I'll just get those details up for you.
Yeah, I agree, but I agree at the same time that the Israeli people are also under fear, but the Israel government uses that fear to implement genocide, and the Palestinian people have been suffering upon a genocide agenda for the last.
Indeed. And look, the situation, okay, in Israel is that there has been wave after wave of suicide bombing, which has caused tremendous problems for the Israeli people. I don't question it. I'm not doubting it. However, the raw statistics tell a story which needs to be confronted, okay? I've retrieved some information from an Israeli site.
Now, this
Israeli Information Center for Human Rights,
right.
Okay? Compiled by an Israeli group.
Yeah.
If there's bias there, at least you know that the people compiling this, and then it's not from Iran. You know, it's not from some, you know, enemy of the state of Israel. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of statistics here, but I want to just highlight some of the really important things. And these are some of the things that don't get through in the news when you hear the statistics. I want to talk about children being killed. The total number of Palestinian minors killed by Israeli security forces in the period from June 2000 to June 2008 is 944. 944 children, minors, have been killed by Israeli security forces. Now, the number of Israeli minors killed by Palestinians. Have a guess at the figure. What do you think it is? Now, we often hear it's like a 3-to-1. We hear 3-to-1 or 2-to-1. What do you think this might be?
Enlighten me.
Try 9-to-1. Okay? The total number of Israeli minors killed by Palestinians is 84 plus 39. So that's around about 120 odd. They call it 130. That's 130 over 944.
Yeah.
It's a big difference, folks. It's a big, big difference.
Yeah.
Now, in during the period,
and we're not saying the score should be even. The score should be freaking zero.
But it's important to remember that by all accounts, Israel has a policy of collective punishment. When one Israeli is killed, they make sure that more than one Palestinian is killed. This is a practice, and I know I may be inflaming things by saying this, but this is a practice that the Nazis used in their occupation of Europe. When one Nazi was killed, they would kill 10 of the people from the occupied country.
Oh, absolutely.
That was a ratio that they would always apply.
It was
deliberate, and it was for a reason.
Yeah, it's a policy of fear, so that you don't attack anyone, because then, yeah, you'll get 10 times the punishment.
I advise everyone to check out this site, Israeli Information Center for Human Rights.
Now we'll link to all the documentaries and this site from our show notes. So check them out at truthnews.com.au/radio/WordPress, or just go to truthnews.com.au. I really this subject is so massive.
Yeah.
But the correlation between war crimes, whoever did it, Mussolini, Hitler, the Nazis, you know, it is inflaming it by saying it's similar to the Nazis. It's similar to any war crime.
Indeed.
And to draw comparisons is not silly. I mean, it's the same. It's the same thing. It's the policy of empire. It's the policy of collective punishment.
I'm sure the Romans did the same thing.
Absolutely. Mm. And now we have the plight of a minority of people that don't have major funding are getting absolutely crushed. And they shouldn't have major funding to fight back, because there should not be a fight. They should be talks. There should be open discussion. And I know this sounds naive, but that is just human.
The current situation is that the borders are closed. The border between Gaza and Egypt is closed. I mean, in any reasonable situation anywhere in the world, when there is a border between two countries, unless those two countries are at war with each other, there is a way of getting from one country to the next. Egypt is not at war with the people of Gaza. Why is the border between Gaza and Egypt closed? All that's happened as a result of that is they dig tunnels. And there are now hundreds of tunnels.
Yeah.
Well known underneath, and you know, Josh, Palestinians are continually dying in those tunnels because they have to use them now. They're forced to use them, even just for basic things like gasoline, even for food. They need them. When the tunnels collapse, people are killed. I mean, this is not even a statistic which is registered as an Israeli, Israeli killing. This is never registered in the statistics, right? Yeah. But when a tunnel collapses on someone who's trying to get gasoline through.
Yeah. So I really feel it's such a complex and deep issue. But at the same time, it's very simplistic. Everyone just needs to talk. I know that sounds very hippie and...
Well, it's simplistically approached by many. But it's not... I think when you say simplistic, I see, yes, there's a simplistic attitude towards it by those who wield power. And the simplistic attitude is, we're going to protect our people. We're going to build a giant wall that will stop the bad people getting in, and we're going to demolish houses on either side of that wall so that they can't use it for any nefarious purpose. And that will make us safer. See, that's idiotic.
And the other simplistic answer is, we'll just keep fighting. I mean, to me, that's the most simplistic thing you can think of. And actually talking is one of the least simplistic answers.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that is precisely what needs to happen.
Dialogue. Understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, some will say there will never be understanding.
Well, I do think now it has reached a point where that is virtually impossible with the current generation. The current generation has been so steeped in blood and violence that there are changes that occur psychologically and emotionally in a human being that really are irreversible. I really don't think it's possible for the current generation to come to an understanding.
Well, I'm not saying just take down the walls and start building marketplaces and everyone just relax and start trading again. It can't happen like that, of course. It's going to take, you know, it's going to take a long time. But first thing that needs to stop is bullets need to stop flying. Shells need to stop going from both sides. But there needs to be an understanding that if a shell flies from one side, you can't just keep retaliating. An eye for an eye and the whole world ends up blind. You know, that's an Albert Einstein.
It's a tricky one, Josh, because you see, the situation that is created when a vastly superior, technologically, militarily, vastly richer, vastly more powerful force is at war with a very, you know, primitively, you know, equipped force, is that what tends to happen is that if the people do nothing, they will merely be oppressed and oppressed and oppressed. If they try to fight back, they will be crushed with maximum force. You know, anything they do will be redoubled back against them. But
well,
if they
not even doubled, you can see
triple,
ten,
quadruple,
nine
tenfold.
Times.
Yeah, but if they do nothing, it won't be that good either. They'll be oppressed in ways that continually restrict and continue. Even just this business of demolishing homes, you see, like a lot of people whose homes are demolished have had nothing to do with the conflict. Now, maybe every now and then a home is demolished, which is owned by someone who is directly involved in it. But I bet you, for every home that is demolished that is directly involved in it, there would be quite a few demolished who've had nothing to do with
it. But this is the madness of war. I mean, you get all the time news articles saying, there was 20 people killed in Afghanistan today, all targeted Taliban. And you think, well, where was the trial that these were actually Taliban? You know, where was the trial that these people were actually anything? You can't just bulldoze places down, say they were the enemy, and then move on with life. I mean, people need to be put on trial.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the general, normal, free...
And at least this has to be able to be discussed. And this just brings me back to Billy Bragg's song, because the third verse of the song, you may have noticed, was about a play which had been written about the life of Rachel Corrie, which was scheduled to be performed in New York. Now, a day before the play was to go live, it was an off-Broadway play, it was cancelled. Now,
of course,
no reasons were given, it was just cancelled and it was never played. What does this remind you of?
Well, it reminds me a lot of the library.
Indeed.
Down the road.
Self-censorship.
Here in Sydney, where the secret police, or what was it, the anti-terror federal police, went and saw these librarians at night time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And intimidated them to cancel a photographic exhibition from a Palestinian human rights photographer, artist.
I mean, not only do we have a situation here where human beings are being treated as less than animals, we have a situation where you can't even talk about it. You can't even actually... Bring it up.
Because then you're anti-Semitic. You know, if you talk about Israel in any form, apart from absolutely how great they are, you'll be called anti-Semitic and that you hate Israel. Well, no, I don't hate Israel. I don't hate the Israeli people. I don't hate Jews. I don't hate Muslims. I have no grudge against any of that. I hate constant war, constant battles. I hate the restriction of liberties and freedoms.
We need to get some Israeli citizens on this show, because I'm quite sure...
Oh, there's plenty.
...that there are plenty who are going to agree with us. And then we can realize that this fake idea that people who criticize Israel are somehow anti-Semitic is a construct. A construct designed to kill dissent, to basically enforce the empire. The empire being some construct that uses Israel as its wedge, that is controlled by forces and powers that we don't even fully understand, but is certainly connected to the UK, the US,
well,
the corporate oligarchy.
That's right. It's connected to the corporate oligarchy, the New World Order, gender.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all in the one, and it is really important that people talk about it, and that's why radio shows like this one, and more around the world, need to keep talking about it, because these are real people, and as the Billy Bragg song talks about, they are turning to non-people. You know, there was a few Palestinians killed. Like it's a brand name, Palestinians killed.
Sure.
It's not young, Billy Johnson.
Yeah.
Was shot in the head. His story. No, it's just a few Palestinians got killed. So, for retaliation of a roadside bomb being found somewhere.
And to be honest with you, it's not even true that the death of an American causes such a huge stir. The story of Rachel Corrie's death was kept very suppressed. And I only found out myself from watching these documentaries that there were two other foreigners who died around the same time as Rachel Corrie, and I knew nothing about it, nothing at all. Well, one of them was another American who had arrived around about the same time Rachel Corrie was there. He was shot in the head as he was helping to rescue children who were under sniper fire from an Israeli guard post, and he was helping them. He was helping them to escape. He was targeted
by
a
sniper
and shot in the head.
You cannot say these are terrorists.
The other one was a director of the film, and it's the film Death in Gaza, which you can watch on Google Video. He was shot in the neck from an Israeli tank while they were filming, and they had all of the...
So the director of the of
during
the
filming
of
the
was killed.
During the actual filming, he was shot.
Yeah.
And they had all of the signage you could possibly have. TV crews, big helmets. They were well known. They'd been there for a while.
Yeah.
It was totally clear what they were doing.
And snipers have very good scopes, so they're not looking at tiny little dots and just firing randomly. These people know exactly what they're doing.
It was deliberate. It was the killing of those Westerners. And since then, there haven't been many people go there again. Like, there's probably still a few there who were there from before, but people aren't going there anymore. Reporters aren't going there. Filmmakers aren't going there. Guess what? It worked.
Well, the insurance won't even cover them to go there anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the policy that the Israelis adopted of killing a few Westerners worked. There's no more coverage, folks. I'm quite personally angry about this. I mean, I'm fed up with holding back on it. You know what I mean? It's just I've been holding back on it too long, and
this is a war that's been going on and on. We keep seeing women and children and civilians being killed, and it's turning into a non. We aren't even seeing news articles about it anymore. It's just like in Iraq. We aren't even seeing stuff that's happening because people have got fatigue. People have got war fatigue. Ah. I'm sick of seeing children dying. It's so depressing. Yeah, Paris Hilton.
Give me Britney Spears.
Give me Britney Spears. You know, I've got my iPod. I've got my gadgets. I've got my computer. I can, you know, look at E! News and see what the celebrities are doing. What a load of rubbish. And folks, these are real people. These are people with stories. These are people that have gone through school. These are people who have got lives, who've got uncles and aunties, who have got potential of being great artists, of beautiful people just like you and me, just like your children, just like your mother, just like your father. They're not just Palestinians.
Look, I think when people realize that the human impact, if they ever do, they change their perspective on this. Anyway, look, we've got to move on. We've got some local news to cover. Watch this space.
Yeah, we've got to keep talking about this.
Yeah, we'll be coming back here.
And on to our local news. Howard accused of war crimes over Iraq troop deployment. From the ABC News, posted Monday the 2nd of June, 2008. A legal brief has been sent to the International Crimes Court, the ICC, alleging former Prime Minister John Howard committed a war crime by sending troops to Iraq. The article goes on to say a loose alliance of peace activists, lawyers, academics and politicians are behind the brief organised by the ICC Action Group in Melbourne. Organiser Glenn Floyd says Mr. Howard should be held accountable for sending troops to a war not sanctioned by the United Nations. Quote, We have produced a 52-page brief of evidence which states to the chief prosecutor of the criminal court that we allege John Howard's actions are war crimes under the Article 8 of the Rome Statute, he said.
Article 8 of the Rome Statute.
The Rome Statute. Yes. Democrat Senator Lynn Allison says the legal brief sent to the IRCC is justified. Senator Allison, who is one of the several eminent people supporting the move, says accountability is important. Well, I agree.
Accountability? Well, that's a new one, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought that was big on the list of John Howard's priorities, but it's certainly important to me, and I think it's probably important to the average Australian voter.
So when you have hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating against going to war, and the Prime Minister says, it doesn't matter what the people think. I've been elected to make choices, and we have great intelligence that says Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and has the ability to deploy weapons of mass destruction within minutes, that we should go to court to war. Now, these have been all so well documented. I mean, we're living in the world of information now where everything is recorded and documented. So you can go back. It's all transparent. And this guy, John Howard, needs to be held accountable for what he did. And he lied to the Australian people to get us into war.
Look, we know that as a result of going to war, many, many completely innocent people died. We know that.
Well, the whole country's been sent to shambles. And I'm not saying Saddam Hussein was a saint and that we should have kept him there. Look, he was a tyrant as well. But it wasn't justified going to war because the justification wasn't to get him out because he was a tyrant. The justification was to get him out because he had weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't have, which he never had, which Hans Blix knew he didn't have and gave total papers every week saying to the UN, no, they don't have it. The UN didn't even sanction the invasion.
With this constant, you know, talk of attack against Iran now, you've got to go back and realize
this is the same thing happening again.
The situation is dire. We've got to get the legal process happening. There's got to be accountability. Otherwise, they will do it again. You see, if we don't put some checks on it, if we don't stop it, they will do it again because they saw they could get away with it.
That's right.
The principle of democracy is that we have to actually keep our government in check. We really do. It's an obligation.
It's an obligation. To live in a free society, freedom isn't free.
Yeah,
it takes folks like you and me.
There's a price tag.
And it's important to always keep government in check. Now, our government went to war on lies, on deceit, and not only to us, globally. This was global deceit, well orchestrated, and they knew exactly what intelligence they had and didn't have.
Believe it or not, Josh, there are countries in the world that don't go around invading other countries.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's actually true. There are quite many. In fact, we are one of a select few of countries that go around attacking and invading other sovereign nations.
Well,
Australia has been regularly involved in attacking countries that did nothing to them. We've done it generation after generation.
So give us some examples.
Sure. In the First World War, Australia invaded Turkey. The Turks never did anything to us. And we sent thousands of troops to the shores of Gallipoli to attack a people that we had absolutely no quarrel with. It was merely because of alliances. It was merely because Turkey was allied with the Ottoman Empire. And no one even knew what that war was about. No one ever understood it. It had some vague concept to do with alliances that was driven by forces that had no direct bearing on the average person in Australia. But we went off to war. It was an incredibly patriotic exercise to serve the empire.
Yeah.
Now, in the Second World War, you may say, well, it was a little different. It wasn't actually so different. When Australia joined the war, the war was a war in Europe. It actually had no direct effect on Australia at all. Australia was already part of the war before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, the attack on Pearl Harbor did bring much more potential threat to Australia through the Japanese Asian coming down, right? Yeah. But that didn't happen until 1941. The Australian government acted to support empire. That's what they did. It had nothing to do with any direct threat to Australia. Again,
well, being part of the Commonwealth, we're sanctioned to do that, aren't we? We're pretty much, you just have to do what the Queen wants.
Since Federation, we have theoretically been an independent country. That's since the turn of the century.
Right.
But in reality, what you say is correct. But it's no longer the Queen. It's now an empire of a different colour. It's an empire which subsumes the Queen. It's a corporate oligarchy, which includes many more countries than just the UK. It appears to include most of the Western
G8 bloc. That's right. It's very different, isn't it? If you look at the original country and outlay of the Commonwealth, and to nowadays be more of that corporate oligarch of bankers or banksters, as I like to call them, taking control of many finance, you know, basically controlling countries through their finances and fiscal control.
Indeed.
So.
And to continue, Australia jumped into the war in Vietnam at the behest of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the successor to John F. Kennedy. Again, with absolutely no threat to us. The Vietnamese never did anything to us, okay?
Yeah.
There was a nationalist movement in Vietnam, which was then opposed by the US involvement. A false flag operation in the Bay of Tonkin triggered a massive US military buildup.
Again, another lie.
And then Australia was asked to participate in a very similar way to the way Australia was asked to participate in the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War. And, of course, without even questioning, without even batting an eyelid, yeah, sure, we're in, sending troops off, you know. And several thousand Australians died in Vietnam. But
do you
many
know what
more Vietnamese were killed.
You know what I find fascinating? That there hasn't been uproar, absolute uproar by the American people or the Australian people that the Gulf of Tonkin incident has now been declassified to be a false flag terrorist, a false flag attack on their own vessels. So it wasn't a terrorist attack, it was a false flag attack. It was a lie saying that their vessel had been shot at by the Vietnamese patrol.
Whereas in fact it was the American PT boat which had attacked a North Vietnamese installation, and they had basically replied. It was completely misconstrued, but done deliberately for the purpose of engineering an incident
and getting people behind maneuvering into the war.
I mean, these things have occurred many times throughout history, and the problem is that with 20 or 30 or 50 years later, you can see what happens. But then by that time, sure, people say it happened, but it's like it was so long ago.
What can we possibly do now? You know, well, look, one thing you can possibly do now is stop it from happening again. And right now, we need to have Howard.
Well, we need to stand by this war crimes commission. We need to stand by due process being served against someone who had the responsibility for running this country. In the same way that they did with Slobodan Milosevic, okay, a leader who was accused of starting war and you know, was basically taken to The Hague and put under war crimes trial, okay? If it could happen to Slobodan Milosevic, if it could happen to Pinochet in Chile, why should it not happen to John Howard?
Absolutely. And what should people do to get behind this movement? I mean, it's all fair and good to say people should, you know, get behind it, but what can we do, you know?
It's an excellent, excellent point. And I think first off, we need to do what we're doing now is let everyone know, because a lot of people don't even know that it exists.
Well, that's right. I mean, the mainstream media organisations, I mean, barely covered it.
I mean, kudos to the ABC for at least reporting it.
I mean, last week we really hammered on the ABC.
Let's give them a bit of a promo. The ABC.
ABC, thanks for
covering. Anti-ABC. No, good on you.
No, honestly, it's fantastic that they're actually doing a bit of a normal journalistic job of covering news. You know?
Well, I think some of us should get onto the ABC Q&A show and raise this war crimes thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, that's a good option.
As an addendum to that, I guess I should point out that a previous plan for Josh to attend the Q&A show was given the kibosh by the ABC, and I'm hoping that that names haven't been permanently recorded in databases.
To a blacklist.
But what actually occurred was, unfortunately, due to some, I think, uncontrolled, over-enthusiastic discussion on the 9/11 Oz forum, which is the site that that I run, 9/11oz.com, and we run a forum there which discusses the 9/11 truth movement. Some people were proposing that that we should run into the ABC Q&A and start screaming out at the top of our lungs, 9/11 was an inside job, and take over the entire studio.
Yeah.
Well, that would not have occurred. It was never a plan. It was merely some rather rash, irresponsible person who wrote that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there are people who constantly patrol through these forums, and that was quoted, and it was replayed. It was pasted into a forum on the ABC, and then within a couple of days, emails went out to say, by the way, we've decided we're booked out and you can't come.
And I can't come. Yeah.
Unfortunate.
But anyway,
yeah.
The Howard war crimes issue is massive for Australians, and we need to push forward.
Howard war crimes, the Bush impeachment, you know, all of these attempts to serve justice are important, even if they don't succeed. History will look back on this and show that somebody tried to do something. And that's extremely important.
In a free and democratic society, it is important to show that the people have power above their government, holding them accountable.
And even in a case of total tyranny, where you are prevented from being able to exercise your freedom, you've got to at least attempt to do it. And this did occur, for example, in Nazi Germany. I know there were groups who tried to bring justice, and they are recognized. And as we may be in a similar situation, we may be facing a period of extreme oppression. We have to face up to that possibility, folks. Okay.
With far greater control grids and mechanisms in place now than they did in the...
But we need to establish 30s. For future generations, even if we can't succeed, that we're doing as much as we possibly can. Okay, we're going to cover some Australian Big Brother news next, and the first cab off the rank is the new plans for Centrelink to be given powers to access private bank account details.
This is an absolutely outrageous plan. I mean, part of living in a free society is that governments and corporations don't have the ability to snoop around in people's financial records.
It's a bit of a worry, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, if I've got a business and I don't want some corporate other competitor commissioning the government or a corporation like that is sponsored by the government, like the Centrelink, to delve into my records to find something. You know, once you start delving, once you start giving corporations
it just crosses over. It crosses the line. It takes away your integrity, your sovereignty as an individual, your freedom.
That's right.
We'll just kick off with the Channel 9 piece on the story, and we'll pick up after that.
Bank banks will be required to give the government the private account details of customers under an unprecedented crackdown on welfare fraud. From July 1, Centrelink will obtain account balances, regular payments and addresses of more than 41,000 suspected welfare cheats. Banks will provide the information through a new encrypted electronic file system. The government says it expects to save $600 million in overpayments across 4 years.
Of course.
A signal to Australian taxpayers that we're serious about ensuring that their taxes are well spent and that those who receive the benefits do the right thing.
Tuesday night's budget provided $138 million for a new data matching computer system with the four big banks. Civil libertarians are outraged and are accusing the government of Big Brother style spying.
So just to clarify, that was a Sky News report. Now, just look at how that was reported. They talk about how it's great for
it's
the taxpayer.
About, it's all about cheats.
It's all about saving money
and catching cheats.
You know, it's saving you money. You know, and then when they talk about the civil libertarians, they just mention that civil libertarians are outraged. It doesn't say why. They don't say, you know, they don't interview someone and say, well, what are the potential reasons why you're outraged? They just make civil libertarians sound like they're crackpots who don't want to save the Australian taxpayer any money.
It sounds like civil libertarians are always just getting all...
just in the way.
Yeah.
And those just, annoying
they just get
rascals.
Their knickers in a twist about almost anything, and they never seem to really say anything, do they? They just get outraged.
They just get outraged,
yeah. They don't have any arguments.
No. You know, there's no reason historically why they should be, of course. Of course there is. Sorry.
I mean, having the government peer into your personal bank account details is not really. Now, by the way, the program cost, what was it? $140 million or something? Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, they've spent taxpayers' money on this.
Yeah, yeah.
On a data matching system.
Yeah.
I mean, hello, that we're paying for this.
Yeah.
We're paying for a system. I mean, any of us could end up on Centrelink.
Look,
I mean, anyone can be on Centrelink. It's not just people who are unemployed.
No.
You can be on Centrelink as a single parent. Yeah. You can be on Centrelink because you have a sickness benefit.
Yeah.
You can be on Centrelink because you're a pensioner.
Look,
I mean, you can be on Centrelink for hundreds of different reasons.
This is nothing. Again, they use the guise. They always use guises. You know, this is the guise of saving money and the guise of tax cheats, of not tax cheats, but welfare cheats. But let's look behind the curtain, right? I've got several friends in Adelaide and around the country in Perth and stuff that have literally been on the dole since they left school. There is no reason for them. They're just, I mean, I hate to say it, I love them, but they're basically lazy. You know, there is no real reason why they should. But they've been conditioned into the fact that, well, it's easy just to surf all day.
And, there are big problems with the welfare state to start off with.
Absolutely.
I think you're highlighting the fact that we all know it's an issue.
Look, if they were really worried about it, they would, you know, try to slimline and try to look at these people, what their real issues are in life. Well, actually, are you really, they'd talk and have interviews with these people, and they'd be realized quite quickly that a couple of my mates of mine, they're just bloody surfies and just like to have no work and don't mind living on poverty line so they can surf all day. You know, but that the issue there, what I'm outlining is that if they really cared about welfare cheats, they'd do some work. They wouldn't sit there orchestrating massive multi-million dollar data matching into private, you know, the infrastructure to look into people's private bank accounts is so huge.
Normally it would just be seen as not cost effective and it normally would be ruled out. But it seems that the Big Brother approach is now has certain value in and of itself. It seems that any measure that involves increased surveillance and increased control is immediately pops to the top of the list of things to do.
Pops to the top of the list and the taxpayer, it's spun in a way that the taxpayer will be better off and that you'll be safer.
And the thing I want to point out, the thing I want to really emphasize, is that although at present in our current society, it does not look threatening. It does not seem like there is some terrible thing happening. Okay. In every previous case in history, when this type of thing is done, and you can read Naomi Wolf's 10 Steps to Fascism, you can find this by studying history, you find out when these fascistic systems are put in place,
yeah,
somewhere down the track, later on, you get burial pits full of bodies. This is where it ends up, folks. In history, over and over again, it has led to this.
And for people to say, oh, you're crazy, you're nuts. No. Is history crazy? You know, this is what's happened. Harold, you're absolutely correct. Time and time and time again, when governments set up control grids under the guise of helping and being the goodies, it always turns out that they have another agenda.
And it's quite fair to ask, why would they want to do that? Why would governments want to commit genocide? Why would anyone want to commit genocide? Well, look at the genocides that have already occurred and find your answers, because they exist. And they're not far away in time.
It was the 1930s, 1940s that Hitler was going nuts.
And we had ethnic cleansing in the 1990s in Eastern Europe. In Yugoslavia we had thousands of women and children being separated from their husbands and the people being led into pits and shot. This occurred.
Well, okay. It's happening in the Congo. You know, it's happening in right now in Africa. It's happening in the Gaza Strip. These are all forms of ethnic cleansing. But we're getting drawn away from the topic, which is control grids and people looking into your
bank. I'm just trying to highlight the seriousness of it for people so that they understand where this leads. And because often people don't quite get it. And I've had discussions with coworkers, as you probably have.
Yeah.
And they just think, well, you know, you're getting your head all messed up. You're getting yourself all flustered.
And they
don't see it. They don't see it as leading anywhere. Whereas when you study history, you see it as a trajectory.
That's right. And honestly, folks, you can't overnight build systems that spy on everyone's bank accounts. It doesn't happen. So if all of a sudden there was a tyrannical government that would all of a sudden be everywhere causing genocide, they can't just instantly look into everyone's bank details and see if you're getting money for any resistance or anything like that. So these infrastructures have to be built over time. And this is exactly what's happening now using the guise of welfare sheets.
Again, sorry to keep coming back to 1930s, but this is what happened in the 1930s. Over a period of a decade, with the help of IBM and others, the German apparatus of total control and ultimately extermination was done by controlling information, by meticulously analyzing information about millions of Germans. They built a system whereby then the SS stormtroopers could come in the middle of the night, knock down your door, and drag you off, and you'd never be seen again.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what they did.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And ultimately, that is what such a system is for. And I think this is what people don't get it. The purpose of the system ultimately is to do that. It has no other beneficial purpose.
The purpose of the system is that to have total control, so whatever the agenda is can easily be brought in. You know, and this is why we have to stop and talk about these issues. And look, I'm sorry that this show is going over time, but here at Truth News Radio Australia, we don't just headline the headlines and that be it. We really delve into every story, you know, because we think they're very important to deconstruct.
We go where the stories are, and our next story is no exception. Sydney schools have been given go-ahead to fingerprint their students. Now, we covered this actually on our inaugural show back in April.
That's right.
Things actually have moved on a little bit, folks.
They've moved on hugely. You know, back then when I heard about this, I was so outraged that I rang the principal, I rang the Minister for Education in New South Wales. I chatted to all of them and basically gave them a history on what's going on. And at the end of the day, what is really happening? You know, because I'd get these answers. A, I'd get the answer of, well, excuse me, sir, we're not fingerprinting. We're not fingerprinting. And I say, well, yes, you are. And they go, no, we're finger scanning.
Yeah. We're for finger scanning.
So they use this Orwellian language twist to say, no, we're not treating you like criminals. We're finger scanning. You know, and this is the mentality of these people. And then they say, look, we're doing it because teachers find it very hard to do roll call and then they miss someone and they're gone. Well, look, what is wrong with calling out people's names one by one and ticking next to their name?
In the story that accompanies this, which I won't play because we're really running short on time, but the there is a news piece, and I suggest you Google for it.
We'll have it in the show notes as well.
Google Sydney schools have been given the go-ahead to fingerprint their students, and you'll come up with a YouTube piece. Now, in the story, Rooty Hill High is the school that they use as the example. And
look,
you can
I'd
see
ask you
in the
to
video,
ring and email Rudy Hill and send your outrage.
Yeah, you can see the kids all lining up, and it's so dehumanizing to look at it. You know, they're all lining up, putting their fingers on this silly little thing. I mean, where's the dignity in that? I mean, what kind of a way to start your day is that? What kind of a message does that send to you? And it implied that they would be tracked throughout the day as well. It's not just when they enter the school. It's continuous.
You've come back from lunch. No, what this is again, another function of control grids, another prison being built into our society. So instead of, there's no prisons, you know, we are living in a prison where everything, you have to be controlled and scanned in and checked in. I mean, these are children. And in the interview in these people, the news actually interviews these small children and says, what do you think? I mean, how are they meant to know any better? How can they possibly know any better? These are children. They wouldn't know history. They don't know what this all means. They go, yeah, it's easy. You know, of course they do. But the real fact of the matter is this is absolutely troublesome because this is conditioning. This is a conditioning of the children to get used to having control, total control by a governing body of their biometric data, which they then give up. You know, I mean, let's just, even if we look past the control and look at what else is happening here, these children are handing their biometric data over to some database which could easily be infiltrated and stolen. So then all of a sudden there's all these people, my kids and your kids' fingerprints all over the World Wide Web that could be used for identification purposes in other formats to cause crimes or whatever. Biometric systems are very, very unsafe.
Let's just...
they are very unsecure.
Let's just pause for a moment to just play devil's advocate for 1 second, because I'd just like to consider what are the benefits of fingerprint scanning technology, because I can see an argument, you see, for efficiency and convenience, and I do know that most laptops now are being sold with finger scanners.
Yeah, because it's very hard to type in your password, isn't it?
Hard to type in, but I mean, there is something to be said for the ease, I guess, for your own personal use of, I mean, I've never used one myself.
To. If I went shopping for a laptop a couple of months ago and most of these things had thumb scanners and I refused to buy them and bought one without it.
Right.
Because I don't want to support these societies where they think biometrics is just a normal and great thing. I mean,
well, to be honest with you,
the
security of my computer has never been a concern for me. I don't even have a login on my computer. Do you?
No,
because it's inconvenient.
The only reason I've got a password on my computer is because my network demands that I have a password so I can
share. At work, we have to.
Yeah,
but for my personal computer. Oh, you have a network at home.
At home, yeah.
Of course, yeah. But I mean, I've got two computers, And I don't have any password access on either of them because it's an inconvenience that I personally don't need. I mean, if my computer gets stolen, you know, it's going to be a disaster for me one way or another. Whether or not people get access to my data,
at the end
it's
of the
still
day,
going to be a disaster for me. And I don't want to be constantly inconvenienced by typing my
But Harold, it's a silly argument.
And we all know there are cracks for them
there's
anyway.
There's technologies out there that, you know, like, for instance, the new iPhone that's coming out is if it gets stolen, you can remotely log in and tell it to sell all the data to self-destruct next time it comes online.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's other ways around protecting your data without biometrically.
I also know that there are hacks and cracks to get into these systems as well.
And hackers have proven time and time again that you can easily copy the biometrics on a passport.
Yeah.
Easily. Boom. Yeah. Without even touching the person. You can walk past someone, copy their biometrics off their passport. You know, biometrics.
So what is it ultimately, do you think, Josh? I mean, just getting back to this question of like, who's it benefiting? I mean, it's clearly benefiting the companies that are producing this equipment. I mean, they're obviously making a lot of money out of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the it's also benefiting the global elite who wish to constantly control the human population. I mean, this is why we have toll roads all starting to scan you wherever you are. This is why you're getting thumbprints on all the laptops, on all the... this is why you're getting biometric scanning at airports. This is why you're getting biometrics in your passport. This is why you're getting biometrics at schools, because it's all about conditioning into that you need to be controlled. You can't just be a normal, free, civil person. You have to be controlled by the nanny state. You have to be controlled by the corporations because, you know, there needs to be order. There needs to be the new world order.
Yeah. Well said indeed. And now let us move on because we've got a couple more topics to cover.
If you want to see these news articles, just please go visit our website, truthnews.com.au.
The next story, which also has a video to accompany it, is the Melbourne curfew. Okay, we'll just play that video for you and we'll pick up at the end.
Police have been given extraordinary powers to ban suspected drunks and thugs from two large city precincts. The police minister denies he's trying to create a police state, rather a safer place for revellers this festive season. Paul Kennedy reports.
Police and government are celebrating the unprecedented anti-troublemakers law without apologies.
If people are reasonably suspected of causing mischief, if they're troublemakers, then they shouldn't be on the streets and it's really time for them to go home and watch a DVD.
New legislation introduced today gives the Liquor Licensing Director the power to label an area an entertainment hotspot. Police then have the power to issue bans for drinkers they suspect, not have evidence, but suspect, are starting trouble.
They then have to leave the area for up to 24 hours.
The areas immediately declared hotspots are the Chapel Street precinct in South Yarra and the Melbourne CBD and South Bank.
In the city in the past year, there has been a 17% increase in assaults alone. The state government has brought in this law believing there was only so much police could do until now.
In my 35 years of policing, I think this is some of the most effective legislation to deal with public order that I've had the pleasure to experience.
It comes as police launch a six-week summer blitz against behaviour in licensed premises.
A no-tolerance approach to inappropriate behaviour, excessive alcohol, assaults, property damage.
And 2 a.m. lockouts are also being employed to deter drunk wanderers from hanging around some city nightclubs.
It stops people migrating between premises during the late hours of the night when the problems have arisen.
The police minister says all the measures are preemptive strikes for the long-term safety of Victorians. Paul Kennedy, National 9 News.
What we have here is another blame game, another guise for another control mechanism. You have alcohol being blamed, which of course is totally irrelevant. I mean, you go out at night and you see total idiots beating each other up.
Yeah,
you see
yeah.
women spewing. You see guys beating up women, guys beating up guys, women beating up women. It's a mess, right?
Sure.
But that's part of serving alcohol.
And
there's ways of getting around that. I mean, if a bar, we've got laws that say if someone's drunk, don't serve them anymore.
Indeed, we already have laws in place to deal with this kind of thing.
Yeah, and the alcohol has been around for thousands of years in the Western world. You know,
And you know, look,
it's always
when these laws were first discussed, the way it was put and the way I understood it was that there was going to be a curfew on entering a bar, so that you were not allowed to enter a bar after a certain time.
Well, that's what they say. Look, here in this news article on The Age, Melbourne venues set for 2 a.m. lockout. But that's not the case.
Now, that I thought was annoying, but not too bad. It didn't bother me that much.
Yeah.
But when I saw the full story, that seems to have been not so well covered.
Yeah.
Much more alarming.
Yeah.
That the police can declare curfews against individuals, against
that's right.
Josh Jackson. Oh,
yeah.
Yes, you are disorderly.
Yeah.
You're banned from this whole area for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're banned from the CBD of Melbourne for 24 hours.
And again, folks,
because you were disorderly.
You can't just listen to the news and say, oh, it's only disorderly. No, these laws come to place and all of a sudden the government doesn't like a dissenter or doesn't like something. Let's say some sort of, you know, the government becomes tyrannical.
It is open.
You, all of a sudden, it's
sky.
Open to,
who knows,
you know,
what
the law
they'll
is,
do with it.
We can just kick you out of this zone.
Who knows what they'll do with a law like that. It is just... I mean, I was slightly gobsmacked.
Yeah.
When I discovered that,
the whole CBD. So, what if you work in the CBD?
Yes.
You can't come back. What's the curfew for? How long? You know. And then I love how they go on to say, "Go home and watch your DVD."
Yeah, time to go home and watch your DVD.
You know. You know. I mean, it's just.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
So extraordinary to think that the Aussies who, you know, got together and had the stockade, the Eureka stockade, and really had a passion for rebellion, don't get outraged that these sort of laws just get passed willy-nilly, day in, day out, that we sit by and watch our government take more and more of our freedoms under the guise of helping us. Under the pretext of terrorism, under the pretext of welfare cheats.
It's a shocker. Now, in the last 5 minutes, we've just got one more topic to cover, which I really want to get in, and I want to treat it with much more attention next time. The story is a story from the Sydney Morning Herald. The headline is, "Empty Homes Now for All to See." The story... Daniel Cox thinks the housing shortage is a myth and he has a map to prove it. Now, this story is focused on the Sydney region and the man in question, Daniel Cox, has developed a website and has been cataloguing the empty properties in our own city.
What's the website?
The website is bubblepedia.net.au.
Now, we've all heard... on the news, oh, rents are going to rise by 30%. Rents are going to go through the roof in the next 3 years. And
man is an anaesthetist by day, by the way. He's not a guy who's short of a buck, and he's not a typical kind of whinging type, right?
Yeah.
He's not one of these typical whinging rat bags.
Mm.
He's an anaesthetist.
Mm.
But he's someone who's probably just got fed up with disinformation, essentially.
That's right, yeah.
You know, we're being told things that aren't true.
Good on him.
And so his Wikipedia-style website allows anyone to upload onto a map the locations of empty houses, vacant lots, and disused buildings anywhere in Australia. Now, we're going to try and get in touch with this man, and we're going to try to interview him for the show.
Yeah, that'd be great. Let's interview him next week if we can.
That's a definite. We're going to do our best for that because this is about our local.
I think he's done an amazing job, and I think it's a very, very important thing that he's done because we're being lied to again, being told that our rents have to go up 30%. I mean, I don't understand how the common teacher or nurse or cleaner or averagely paid person can survive in Sydney with the rent prices, let alone buy in Sydney. Let's just think about renting. When you can't rent, there's nothing left to do.
When you can't rent, what do you do? Stay in a hotel. I don't know. Where do you go from there?
You can't. You stay on the streets.
It gets pretty tough.
Well, unless, or you share with 15 people in a single room, like you're living in some third world country.
So in short, we've been told that there is a housing crisis. We've been told there's a terrible shortage of properties. This man has proven, and in a previous article, which I don't have up right at the moment, the actual figure of around about 120,000 was quoted. Yes, it's here. The Herald revealed that there are more than 120,000 vacant residential dwellings in Greater Sydney. And this was a figure from the census. This is not a figure from this chap. This is a figure from the census. This is not to be questioned.
And the story, I mean, he goes on to saying that there's tax kickbacks for not actually renting your place out, but saying it's for rent, but never advertising it.
Yeah, there are some loopholes which are being exploited, and I'll have to get more detail on that. But apparently, yes, there are some loopholes which are being exploited, which are obviously benefiting property developers and property owners to such an extent that they don't even want to rent properties out. It's extraordinary. Because, I mean, normally the income you get from rent would outweigh any other benefits, but there is something very fishy going on.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll
that's probably
get
a wrap
in touch
for tonight. Sorry to interrupt.
No, we'll hopefully we'll get in touch with him. I'm Joshua Jackson.
And I'm Heroin Fenton.
Until next time, may the truth set you free.